France's political and media elite have stigmatized Muslims to a degree which has gutted the nation's claim to be a global leader in freedom of religion, thought, and speech. The three most popular candidates in the presidential election all seem to be trying to outdo each other in Islamophobia, which has France's Muslims expecting the state-sponsored racism to be even worse over the next 4 months. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Iran's lead delegate to the Vienna talks says the eighth round of negotiations aimed at restoring the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action will be focusing on the two issues of verification and guarantees.
The Islamic Republic of Iran has announced that if an agreement is reached, the side that violated the deal, meaning the U.S., should remove the sanctions first. Iran should verify the removal of sanctions and only then take measures within the framework of the JCPOA.
Ali Bagheri-Kani says the U.S., which withdrew from the JCPOA in 2018 under the administration of Donald Trump, also needs to provide guarantees it will not withdraw again or impose sanctions in violation of the deal.
Iran's rightful and logical demand has been getting guarantees from the other side, and this, as well as the issue of verification, have in principle been accepted by them. But discussions need to take place on the mechanism, frameworks and criteria involved in order to reach a framework for an agreement.
Bagheri said the sides are set to discuss banking and financial sanctions in the coming days. Meanwhile, EU coordinator Enrique Mora says the talks need to end within a reasonable period of time, which, according to him, should be a matter of weeks rather than months. Mora said difficult political decisions need to be made, both in Tehran and Washington. Iran says if the other side shows it's ready to effectively remove sanctions and give the necessary guarantees, the talks can conclude successfully. Talks will continue at the level of experts and deputy foreign ministers in the coming days as efforts intensify to make the challenging prospect of a restored JCPOA a reality. Homa Lezgi, Vienna.
It was the year UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson pledged to build back better. Some critics argued this was not just about restoring the UK's fiscal position after the ravages of COVID on the economy, but on reviving the country's international reputation that had taken a global hit after a few glaring missteps. If Johnson was hoping for a glorious scorecard to see out his political year, he was going to be left disappointed. Not only had he failed to make vital political inroads on the international stage, some pointed to the UK having gone backwards in some respects.
Britain no longer has this huge empire that it once had. It doesn't have a presence in any serious sense east of Suez. It was badly defeated in Afghanistan over the summer. There's 20 years of war, which has shown we've come completely full circle as a result of that war. Britain is being kind of cut down to size, I think, in terms of, you know, when people look at it, its actual role in the world is much less.
For those expecting something different when it came to the sometimes subservient relationship that exists between Washington and London, well, 2021 was yet another year of disappointment, with the US setting the political agenda and Britain following that well-trodden path. The White House meeting between the US President Joe Biden and Britain's bumbling PM underscored the power imbalance between the two nations. After the trade deals dangled by the Trump administration failed to materialize, Johnson returned from Washington with nothing like the $300 billion in agreements, not that you'd sense the crushing disappointment at the time.
Then, of course, there's the progress that we're making in the defense technology partnership that you've led and with our Australian friends, that I think has great potential to benefit the whole of the world and the security of the whole of the world. So, Joe, thank you for having us, and I think, you know, we're boosting our shared agenda. We want to build back the world together with you. And I think we want to renew and strengthen our transatlantic bond. And it feels to me like it's going very, very well.
The shambolic withdrawal and embarrassing military climb down experienced by Britain's military after the US announced it was leaving Afghanistan exposed the UK's strategic weaknesses and had the minister in charge at the time attempting to explain the chaos away.
Of course, didn't put.
So that's a lie.
We did not put the welfare of animals above individuals. I'm not accusing anyone of lying. I'm just correcting the facts. What is certainly true is that we had a lot of people rushing to get out of Afghanistan for all sorts of reasons. And I think it's right that we had a process in place.
Not only was the UK caught on the back foot having to follow the US on the Afghanistan issue, its foreign policy position continues to ape Washington's agenda on China, Russia, Iran, Yemen, and Palestine, to name but a few. Perhaps the only area of foreign policy divergence is Brexit, where Washington has reiterated its pro-Brussels sentiments.
Britain's most complicated and increasingly acrimonious foreign policy situation is the one that London and Brussels now find themselves in. Having exited the European Union, Britain now finds itself at odds with its former ally, a situation that has not been this bad in decades.
Lord Frost passing the job of securing Britain's post-Brexit policies onto Foreign Secretary Liz Truss, it will be an uphill task for 2022.
The trade deals that Britain has made since Brexit have amounted to very little, including there hasn't been one with the United States. And therefore, Britain is sort of desperately trying to cling on to this military role, while at the same time the wider economic issues are not necessarily going in their favour.
Britain's continued political pivot towards the US remains a risky strategy that has yet to bear genuine fruits for the UK in its own aims, with the country's Prime Minister still in bombastic, flag-waving mood. Perhaps Boris Johnson feels tethering the UK's fortunes so closely to that of the US is still the way to go, despite new global realities indicating otherwise. Amina Taylor, London.
A meeting was held here in Western Kabul to bring the Islamic Emirate and the people closer together. The meeting was organized by a Shia association to pave the way for national solidarity in Afghanistan. During the meeting, the religious leaders and the Taliban officials stressed the need for mutual trust between people and the government.
One of the main responsibilities of the ruling group is nation building. Afghan nation is mainly composed of our Shia and Sunni brothers. We are part of United Ummah of Islam. In order to have a united Afghanistan, we should trust each other and rely on mutual values. The new government needs to represent all sections and ethnicities of Afghanistan.
Conspiracy is one of US and the Soviet Union's main heritages in our country. They destroyed the soil with it. The Islamic Emirate need to find a way for creating unity in Afghanistan. We are all Muslims, and we believe in God. Anyone who lives in Afghanistan is entitled to live in peace and play their role in the reconstruction of the country.
The religious leaders warn against foreign interference in Afghanistan and stress the urgency to get united.
The only thing that our country needs is peace and unity. We should build trust and get united. We must distinguish between our friends and enemies.
After taking power in August, the Taliban leaders have repeatedly held talks with the Shia community seeking their support and allegiance. Shia Afghans support an Islamic government but believe it must be an inclusive one. They want to see people in power who make Afghanistan a safe place for all. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Tensions in several areas in northern West Bank have been high in the recent days, particularly in the village of Burqa, northwest Nablus. On Saturday night, over 250 Palestinians were wounded by the Israeli forces in Burqa. one day after thousands of Israeli settlers attacked the village under the protection of Israeli army. The Palestinian Authority held the Israeli regime fully responsible for what it described as expansionist colonial war. The PA also called on the international community to put pressure on the Israeli regime to stop its aggression and settlers' violence.
The only side which should be held accountable is the Israeli regime. It's responsible for the increasing violence by the Israeli settlers against the Palestinians. It also bears responsibility for a dangerous escalation likely to happen in the occupied lands.
The Palestinian factions have said the settlers' organized terrorism requires the development of a popular action in various ways. This means forming popular guard and protection committees to defend the Palestinians and repel settlers' attempts to storm Palestinians' villages and towns. Anti-settlement organizations have warned that if the settlers' systematic attacks are not stopped, they will turn into real massacres against Palestinians.
I think if it continue like this, it could lead to disasters, maybe massacres. We don't know, but the way that they are attacking the people, the way that they are attacking the houses, trying to enter inside the villages, to enter houses and beat the people there to the extent of killing, it shows us that this has to be stopped and has to be confronted strongly by the Palestinians.
Almost 10 days ago, Israeli army imposed military reinforcements after an Israeli settler was killed in the Israeli settlement of Homish near the village of Burqa. Since then, tensions have been high as Israeli forces installed several makeshift checkpoints around the cities of Jenin and Nablus. Thousands of settlers have visited the site over the past days and terrorized Palestinians. Today, Palestinians in many areas are again facing violence and attacks from both armed settlers and Israeli forces. Different political powers say there's an urgent need for stepping up all forms of resistance against Israel. Palestinians call for an international protection, along with dismantling of all Israeli settlements. Mona Qandil, North Occupied, Ramallah.
Israel is stepping up its acts of violence against Palestinians with impunity. Attacks by settlers have grown more audacious recently. In the latest incident, over 250 Palestinian protesters were injured in an Israeli attack on the village of Burqa near Nablus in the occupied West Bank that happened late Sunday. From live rounds and tear gas to rubber bullets and stun grenades, the Israeli forces fired everything they could to ward off the Palestinian protesters. It all started when the Israeli army moved in, deploying soldiers to the Nablus-Jenin road to secure dozens of buses packed with settlers. They also closed off the entrance to the village of Burqa. And that infuriated the Palestinians and triggered protests. In recent days, Burqa has been a flashpoint of clashes. Israeli settlers with protection from the army have attempted to raid Palestinian houses there. In a separate accident that happened a few days ago, an Israeli settler ran over a Palestinian woman, killing her near Ramallah in the northern West Bank. It came just hours after settlers attacked a nearby village that rapidly escalated into a round of violence with Israeli troops firing rubber bullets and tear gas and injuring at least 125 Palestinians. Pro-Palestinian activist Paul Lorodi believes that Tel Aviv is seeking a policy of isolating Palestinians and forcing them out of their homes.
But the strategy of the Israelis has been to surround large cities like Nablus, as they did in Qarqilia, and to isolate them and to destroy their economy and to force Palestinians to find work elsewhere.
The atrocities go on, but the international community remains silent. That has raised criticisms that the lack of global reaction to the situation in fact gives the green light to the Israeli regime to continue with its unjust policies. Even the UN has lashed out at the world community for remaining tight-lipped in the face of the Israeli crimes. UN Special Rapporteur for Human Rights in the Occupied Palestinian Territories, Michael Link, says the international community must hold Israel accountable for its occupation of Palestine. He says Tel Aviv is refusing to comply with the UN resolutions, including UN Security Council Resolution 2334, which calls for an end to settlement expansion in the occupied territories. Anti-war activist Ken Stone believes a concerted international effort is needed to tackle the situation.
Behind the colonial project in Palestine is the might of the U.S. empire. And the U.S. and its allies, including, unfortunately, Canada, enable this kind of mistreatment of the Palestinians.
Palestinians are witnessing bolder and more violent attacks with each passing day, and they are waiting to see when the international community will finally move to stop the injustice.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday 5 things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
Spotlight.
Doing us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of information.
The Spotlight.
$777.7 billion is the exact amount of the U.S. military budget for the year 2022. President Joe Biden signed a bill into law amid protests from progressives and anti-war groups. The U.S. military budget is by far the largest in the world, more than triple that of China. That's the second biggest military spender and larger than the military budget of 11 countries combined. So why should the U.S. prioritize military spending and raise its already huge budget? And what has been the result of Washington's military adventurism and perpetual wars? Under more urgent issues and predicaments in the United States to be addressed?
The United States has approved its biggest defense spending bill in history, allocating $778 billion for the fiscal year 2022. President Joe Biden signed the National Defense Authorization Act into law on Monday following Congress approval. The proposed defense spending is up about 5% compared to the previous year. However, the surprising part of the story is that Congress has allocated about $25 billion more for the military than the Biden administration had requested for. The budget allocates over $740 billion to the Pentagon, while nearly $28 billion would go to the nuclear weapons program. A good portion will be spent on hypersonic weapons and other advanced weaponry, raising the fear of another arms race with Russia. It ensures that the U.S. gives around $3.8 billion to Israel as part of its annual military aid to the regime. But around $7 billion of the hefty defense budget is for what the U.S. calls the Pacific Deterrence Initiative, a plan to strengthen America's presence in the Indo-Pacific region against China. That also means an open call for support for Taiwan, which China regards as its own territory. The budget also envisages $300 million in military aid for Ukraine, which has been a source of tensions between Russia and the US-led Western military alliance, NATO. Many experts believe that Washington's claim of defending Taiwan or Ukraine are just pretexts to make the US military-industrial complex more profitable.
The military industry, military-industrial complex in the States, it really controls the economy. This idea that America's trying to defend Taiwan or Ukraine, these are just pretexts for the profits of the military-industrial complex.
According to data released by the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute in April, the massive U.S. military budget was by far the largest in the world in 2021. That was more than the budget of 11 other developed and developing countries combined. That despite the fact that COVID-19 forced many countries, such as South Korea and Russia, to shift part of their planned military spending to pandemic response. Critics argue that the unwarranted increase in defense budget could instead be diverted to address more urgent domestic priorities, such as social injustice or fighting against the pandemic. The critics also say that the budget is more than enough to vaccinate everyone in the world. In July, an anti-war group, Code Pink, warned that the proposed $25 billion hike in the Pentagon budget alone could end homelessness in the United States. The group accused lawmakers of trying to increase the profits of military contractors than meeting the needs of working class. The approved military spending bill also represents a bump from former President Donald Trump's last budget of $740 billion, which was then criticized by Biden's fellow Democrats. Upon entering the White House in January 2012, President Biden had pledged a massive overhaul of U.S. strategy toward the world to make it a better place. However, Biden continues to follow Trump's aggressive and warmongering policies, as the National Defense Authorization Act reflects that billions of dollars will go for the U.S. unending wars across the globe.
Welcome to the Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi, and these are our guests in today's edition. from anti-war. We have anti-war activists with the Answer Coalition, Richard Becker in San Francisco. Senior analyst with Foreign Policy in Focus, Ian Williams, is also joining us out of New York.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both, gentlemen. Let's go to Richard first. You know that the U.S. Military budget was already huge, and it's getting another 5% boost for the year 2020. And there are some observers who are describing this as indefensible spending. So what does this signify?
Well, I think that the U.S. military budget is a crime against humanity. And if you look at how much has been spent now since the end of World War II, I don't think we can actually exactly calculate it, but we're talking about in the neighborhood of $60-70 trillion that's been spent on militarism, and that might be a conservative estimate. And we have to point out that the debate that has been going on in the U.S. Over the bill, the so-called Build Back Better bill, that would be in its latest iteration, which has been turned down, or it looks like it's going to be not approved, $1.75 trillion, but that's $175 billion per year over 10 years, which isn't said often enough. That is, so we're talking about 10 years. And this budget is a budget for global domination. It's not a defense budget. It's wrong to call it that, actually. It is a budget for global domination, and the main target of it is China, the so-called Indo-Pacific region, dominating Indo-Pacific region.
Sure.
And so
we'll come to that.
This is the real purpose.
Okay, good. Now, Ian, the U.S. has been spending more on military than 11 countries combined. And let me name those countries: China, India, Russia, the U.K., Saudi Arabia, Germany, France, Japan, South Korea, Italy, and Australia. Now, should we expect more U.S. wars and military interventions like the ones in Syria, Yemen, and Ukraine?
It's a complex position, as Richard Becker's just pointed out. There are many motives here. Quite apart from any foreign policy and military strategy, there's the need to make profits. There's all of these companies want to sell military equipment to the Pentagon. There are all sorts of people in the Pentagon who hope to get jobs with those military companies as soon as they retire, who are pushing for, you know, ridiculously overpriced schemes. And there's an element of prestige which comes into these things. It's like the British have just built two world-class aircraft carriers, but have got no airplanes for them. This is just so that they can, you know, this is a Freudian show to the world. And it's similar with a lot of the U.S. budget, which is wasted. The second part is, you know, they can get excuses. There's no doubt that Russia is occupying part of Ukraine, parts of Georgia, pretty much half of Moldova. So, you know, there is a military threat there. But it's not what they're doing is not intended to counter that threat. That's being used as an excuse to boost the expenditure. Similarly, in the South China Sea, the People's Republic has threatened massive missile attacks against Taiwan, which has got a defense treaty with the U.S. But what the U.S. is doing is using that as an excuse to build up the carrier forces in the Pacific because they realized that was where it was weakest, and they don't have a layer of European states that might absorb anything. Mm. I mean, there's very little effort at strategic thinking. The only people who are doing the strategic thinking was the project for the New American Century, who gave you the Iraq War, and their premise was the U.S. was in an eventual economic decline, so they had to consolidate a military advantage over the rest of the world while they could. And that is a lot of the thinking behind, one of the many strands of thinking behind all of this. But the major one is nobody has ever voted, very few people ever vote no against a defense budget. You have the Israel lobby on side for it because they want to purloin a considerable proportion of it. So the bigger the budget, the more chances they have of picking pockets on the way. And of course, there might well be wars that the Israelis get the US into that have to be paid for. So there are many, many different aspects. And the fetishism of the US military is quite disturbing for an objective observer. I mean, the whole thing of vets, which you don't see in Europe, and the fact that all someone has to do is appear on television in a uniform and is assumed to be credible. In most parts of the world, of course, so you see someone appearing on television in uniform, you think, oh, what's this dictatorial swine doing now?
Mm. Okay. Now, Richard, as you know, the U.S. left Afghanistan, where it has squandered lots of taxpayer money, as they themselves admitted. So what did the U.S. gain in that country? I mean, why should it allocate such a colossal amount of money to military spending again?
Well, it is definitely true that the military spending is immensely profitable for the military industrial corporations and for its executives and so forth. But I think that, you know, we should look at what President Biden said back in April when he said that we are in competition with China over who will win the 21st century. Uh-huh. I mean, why? Why are we in competition? You know, why are we not in collaboration and cooperation with China? The people of the United States, I would argue, are being constantly propagandized about the so-called threat of China. But the reality is that we have no interest in competition with China over winning the 21st century. That's all about empire. That can't be about anything else. We should be looking to how we can collaborate with other countries over what are really existential threats, like the climate catastrophe that is already underway. And doing away with nuclear weapons and doing away with war, those would all be immensely beneficial to the people of the United States and the people of the world. Instead, the vital resources, the precious resources of the planet are to a large degree being wasted and thrown away. I mean, it's not that they're providing anything that's of use to humans. It's only produce the weaponry of death and destruction. And this goes on and on and on, but the propagandizing is very strong that somehow we should have an interest, and we the people of the United States, have, aside from those corporate executives and the people making the big salaries, we have no interest in this at all, and we should point out and fight against the misappropriation of resources for purposes that are antithetical to the interests of humanity.
Okay, now, Ian, let's take a look at the U.S. An insight. Look, there are serious issues at home that require urgent attention and spending, of course. One being the millions of Americans living on food stamps. And also we have the growing social injustice. So why should there be such extravagance on militarism?
Well, this is the point that one of the few people, is Bernie Sanders, who raises this regularly, and the other members of the coalition. You have to realize that the defense budget has been totally sacred. To challenge the defense budget means you're anti-American, pro-Russian, pro-communist, pro-Chinese. Yeah. And to get them to say, look, we don't need it, the commonsensical approach just doesn't get an approach. It's a shibboleth. It's unchallengeable in the newspapers on the floor of Capitol Hill to say, do we really need all this stuff? Do we really need these weapons that more often than not don't work? Or ill-designed. You know, and there are many examples where the Pentagon has gone ahead and retired very effective weapon systems and replaced them with expensive, ineffective ones. For years, the Pentagon was trying to kill the Warthog, which is one of the most versatile aircraft that the U.S. military had. And it was the Marines that insisted on it because they were the ones actually doing the fighting and they wanted this. But the Air Force wanted super prestige, highly expensive F-35s that fall out of the sky at regular intervals. One of them recently ran off the end of a British aircraft carrier. A very dubious piece of equipment, but expensive and profitable, which is what counts. And they make lots of swooshing and bangs and they look and make nice patterns in the sky. But highly ineffective, probably. We have to see that yet because it hasn't been battle tested. But more to the point is, the defense budget is sacrosanct. More people need to challenge it. But you don't have to challenge it by saying, well, the Russians are really very nice and the Chinese are really beautiful people who just wish peace and goodwill to everyone. There's lots of people around the world who will testify that both of these statements are not strictly true. But on its own rights, it is unjustifiable to spend so much money on weaponry that isn't called for, isn't used, and as you rightly point out, could be used at home. You know, this is the only country in the world where there's no national health service, pretty much. I think it goes along with Somalia as the only country that doesn't provide paid maternity leave. This country is the bottom, the pits, in so many areas of social welfare. And every time someone tries to spend money on them, the people who just voted for this defense budget will be screaming, what about the deficit? What about the deficit? They'll be leaving debts for the younger generation. Mm-hmm. The younger generation aren't likely to make it into the next generation if the way things are going, between healthcare and poverty and the homelessness. That doesn't count. Money for people is always bad in the conservative playbook. Money for weapons is always good in the conservative playbook.
Right. Now, Richard, among the other problems that the U.S. is facing, you know, the country has had the largest loss of life to COVID. And Mr. Trump's wish came true. America became first in this regard. And people, businesses, they also got adversely affected by the pandemic. So why shouldn't this get a higher priority than military spending?
Well, you know, I also have to say that the military budget that has just been signed, the $778 billion, is not the entire military budget. I mean, it's consuming huge amounts of what's needed to meet people's needs, but that number does not exactly explain the military budget. You have to take into account $270 billion next year for the Veterans Administration. I mean, I'm for the veterans getting treatment, but it should rightly be counted as a cost of previous wars. And an immense part of the national debt is due to past wars, and those wars are not done being paid for, and they're not included in the military budget. So it's estimated that between the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, they will eventually cost somewhere between $7 and $8 trillion. Most of that's going to be paid out of national debt. So really, when we talk about the figures, we have to be more realistic than just the Pentagon budget. And this is really what's consuming what people need. People need to have childcare. They need to have education without having to go into debt for your whole life. They need to have a comprehensive healthcare system. There needs to be affordable housing. More and more people are living out in the streets or are crunched into tiny apartments that are unfit for habitation. And also, you know, I think that there has to be some payback to the countries that have suffered under U.S. wars. You know, there really has to be the assistance in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in Vietnam even, you know, which has recovered a lot, but not completely from the devastating U.S. wars there. It's not there's a lack of wealth or a lack of money to meet these needs. It's that the decision is made over and over and over again to meet the needs of the military-industrial contractors and those corporations and not meet the needs of the people. And we just saw it again with this ridiculous argument that, you know, to have to spend $175 billion a year for the next 10 years on meeting some of, and not really even a large part, of the needs that people have, that is, you know, that's reckless and it's adding to the deficit. No, it's nothing compared to what the military has added to the deficit. Mm-hmm.
Now, Ian, you both mentioned China, and now let me give you some figures. This PDI thing, that Specific Deterrence Initiative, $7.1 billion will go to this PDI, and that's for building of forces, you know, in Asia-Pacific to surround China and also establish a network of long-range missiles near China's coast. Now, given such an approach, is it Sino-U.S. relations on a collision course?
Not necessarily. Look, they're on a natural historical collision course in that the U.S. has been used to being the number one and only superpower, and China is challenging it. And I hate to say it, but if you want to be cynical, the last two world wars started off when previous outpowers decided they wanted to be in and challenge the existing great powers. It's a sort of natural course of history. But we do assume that we're in a more civilized era and people can talk their way through this and get to what the business world calls win-win solutions for everybody. And it looked for a while as though we did this. You know, the Chinese provided goods for the Americans and then they reinvested the money in U.S. Treasury bonds. So everybody was happy. It's only recently that an element of aggression and militarism has come in. But there's no doubt the Chinese are thinking these terms as well. The Chinese are talking about how they need to be able to counter American threats. Mm-hmm. So really, somebody has to blow the whistle sometime and say, children, grow up and stop talking like this. Let's get together and have a proper conference and discuss, get all these issues on the table and discuss them. But, you know, the other side, the Russians and the Chinese have their hawks as well, and they have their own military complexes. And the problem is when you have these various factors all combining together, there's no telling what happens when a catalyst comes, you know, when a Sarajevo or a Taiwan Straits issue comes up and somebody does something silly, some local commander, and the consequences can be cataclysmic for the planet as well as just the locals. And it's one of the difficulties. When you have huge stockpiles of combustible weapons like this in battle zones, people get the temptation to use them, and they get blown up, and you know it's downhill all the way from then.
And maybe I'm not that's sure also the case for Ukraine, before. Ian, as you mentioned. So let me ask Richard. We have only 1 minute left. Richard, there's also $300 million in military aid for Kiev, and you know what the situation is like. So will this push the region closer to war?
Well, I think we have to think that it will. And we have to be clear about this. It's not Russia that's been moving westward to surround the United States. It's NATO that's been moving steadily eastward, despite many promises that were made to the contrary, to surround Russia. And we have the first island chain, as the Indo-PAC U.S. commander talks about, surrounding China on its eastern border, on its eastern the eastern side of China. We have to be clear on who's being aggressive here. And the aggression, I don't think either China or Russia wants a war, but they don't want to be surrounded and annihilated. And I think that's very understandable. But the U.S. policy is a highly dangerous one, and it can lead to war. And particularly some of the maneuvers that are going on around the South China Sea are really, really ominous and very, very far away from the United States, but very, very threatening to world peace.
Unfortunately, we're out of time. Thank you so much. Thank you, my guests. We had senior analysts with Foreign Policy in Focus, Ian Williams in New York, and also anti-war activists with Answer Coalition, Richard Becker in San Francisco.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
in the limelight.
The Biden administration is acting with near total continuity to Trump. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by John Canefol, writer. This article is published under the heading, A Year In, Biden Hasn't Fulfilled Promise to Repair Refugee Resettlement Program. Stay tuned for more. On June 2020, World Refugee Day, then-presidential candidate Joe Biden made his most sweeping statement to date on how his administration would differ from his predecessors on the rights of migrants. Gone would be the xenophobia and racism that were the unabashed tenets of Trump's refugee and immigration policy. Biden pledged to increase the cap on refugees allowed into the United States to 125,000 in his first year in office, and to restore America's historic role as leader in resettlement and defending the rights of refugees everywhere. His first year did not go as promised. In the fiscal year ending in October 2021, the United States only resettled 11,411 refugees through regular channels. That's 400 fewer than the previous fiscal year, which itself saw historically low resettlement and far short of the 62,500 that Biden eventually ordered to be allowed to resettle in the United States in his first year in office. The U.S. has only released data for the first month of the new fiscal year, which shows 401 refugees have been resettled. Biden did finally raise the cap to 125,000, which, if met by the end of September 2022, would represent a massive turnaround not just over previous years, but of the last two decades. The last time the U.S. resettled more than 100,000 refugees was in 1994. An additional 40,000 Afghans were temporarily allowed into the United States under a program called Humanitarian Parole, though they have not been issued green cards, and in most cases, their status expires in a year or two. Roughly 30,000 Afghans still housed on military bases are waiting to be allowed into the United States. Vargas, policy director at the International Refugee Assistance Program, told Truthout that Biden's low numbers have a lot of things to do with Donald Trump's successful dismantling of the resettlement infrastructure, but plenty of blame rests with the current administration as well. Biden's rhetoric of a human rights-centric approach to migration and foreign policy may not be an overarching guiding principle, but one of the many competing considerations, he said. Other refugee advocates echo the degree to which Trump dismantled the refugee screening and support apparatuses. Danielle Grisby, Director of International and External Affairs at a community sponsorship hub, which connects refugees with local sponsors and advocates, said, "The process of facilitating the resettlement of displaced persons into the U.S. is not like a light switch that can be turned on and off. The damage inflicted on the resettlement infrastructure will take significant time to repair. Biden's immigration, asylum, and refugee policies in general have been a decidedly mixed bag. His administration has followed through on some long-held progressive priorities, but many others have fallen to the side. In mid-December, the administration ended the long-standing U.S. policy of holding immigrant families in prison-like detention centers, according to Axios. This is truly a good development, even though the treatment of migrant families writ large continues to be poor. American Immigration Counsel Aaron Richlin Melnick tweeted in response to the news, "Families can still be subject to confusing and arbitrary seeming effort, court hearings and procedures, and many of them face significant economic hardships. For all the criticism Trump deserves for dismantling the existing refugee apparatus, the Biden administration has not made rebuilding it a top priority. Even this development is tempered, as the Department of Homeland Security will continue to rely, at least partially, on using GPS-enabled ankle bracelets to surveil migrants. Advocates have long criticized the use of bracelets, saying they lead to stigma and are unnecessary to compel migrants to appear in court. In other cases, the Biden administration is acting with near total continuity to Trump. Biden continues to invoke a 1944 Public Health Act called Title 42, which allows border agents to turn away asylum seekers without providing them an opportunity to make their case before a judge. Trump used the pandemic as an excuse to implement the rule, which many saw as a flimsy pretext to pursue his openly bigoted policies at the southern border. Biden has also re-implemented Trump's so-called Remain in Mexico policy, which denies asylum seekers the right to live in the United States while their case is pending. Legal scholars say this practice is illegal and in violation of the U.S. treaty obligation and international law. The plight of refugees is no longer in the corporate headlines, but in 2016, the subject was a major political issue. Then-candidate Donald Trump demonized refugees and asylum seekers constantly, especially Syrians fleeing their country's war. Following his lead, nearly every other Republican candidate promised restricted refugee resettlement to the United States. Trump and Miller attempt to ban people from Muslim-majority countries from entering the country in the administration's first week in office. After initially striking the policy down, the Supreme Court ultimately gave the ban its blessing once North Korea and Venezuela were added. The outrage over the Muslim ban was perhaps only matched by the administration's family separation policy at the southern border. Deeply intertwined with migration from conflict zones in migration is driven by climate change. The United Nations predicts that 200 million people could be forced from their homes by 2050 due to extreme weather. For all the criticism Trump deserves for dismantling the existing refugee apparatus, the Biden administration has not made rebuilding it a top priority, despite early promising signs. In February 2021, Biden issued Executive Order 14,013, which called for the U.S. Refugee Assistance Program to be rebuilt and expanded consummate with global need. The order also revoked the discriminatory restrictions Trump had imposed and called for additional reporting from the responsible executive agencies to determine what other changes could be made to address the refugee backlog.
Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. Mm-hmm.